Tennis Podcast, Season 3, Episode 16, Stardate 98486, Mark 13. My name is Timothy. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Kuhlein in Mississauga, Ontario.
Hello there.
I'm also joined by Jaime Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
And this week we'll be discussing the Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 6, Scavengers Episode, Orama, or something like that. Anywho, all right, let's jump. Wait, I guess we have no Ask Spotcast because nobody loves us, right? No? Do we ever check?
I was going to say, when was the last time we checked?
I've checked every once in a while. I haven't checked in a while.
In a fortnight? Yes. You can tell I've been watching The Crown, right? all righty. Let's jump in with Jonathan's first fact checked.
On our last episode, we were having a good conversation about 007 and the 00 agents and the fact that Lashana Lynch is going to be 007 in the new James Bond movie. And so we had this conversation about how were there other 00s? Of course, but after 25 movies, it's hard to keep track of everything. So there's this great article that I found a link to. We'll put it in our show notes from Screen Rant, where they talked about the fact that it isn't the first time we've seen a female 00 agent. Of course, 007 has always been James Bond, but we have seen in as far back as Thunderball, back in the Sean Connery era, there was a female 00 agent present at a briefing scene. And basically, this article outlines all the different times we've seen a female 00 agent. There's one in World Is Not Enough, but it is pretty poor and Spartan. So the fact that we are seeing, you know, we're actually going to see one in action. We did see Ms. Moneypenny, the new Ms. Moneypenny, Naomi Harris's character, was a little more sort of field agent-y and badass in Skyfall, but she wasn't really, you know, in the same 00 category. But it's still neat to sort of track that, you know, there have been these nods that, of course, there are female 00 agents. We just haven't really gotten the kind of respect for them that I think we'll get after seeing No Time to Die.
No Time to Die. No Time to Get COVID. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
So MI6, is that a legit thing, or is that just fictionalized for the stories? Because MI5 is real, right?
Yeah, I think MI6 is supposed to be the fictional MI5.
An unknown branch of the British government.
Yeah.
Spy games or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right. My one is real quick. We talked about David Cronenberg last week, and we didn't know the name of his character's name. The character's name is Kovich. They may have mentioned it in the show, but none of us picked that up. I got that from the IMDb database. And my second follow up is the three seashells that Jaime mentioned, and of course, you know, Jonathan guffawed. And I had to go look it up because I couldn't remember what the three seashells was about.
Well, that's a fun one to say three times fast, isn't it?
Yes, it's a reference from the. It was not Judge Dredd, but it was
Demolition Man.
Man. Is that Judge Dredd? Judge Dredd?
It's the same actor.
It's Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah. Okay, but it's not the character.
Not the same character, no. No, he plays John Spartan.
Like, you know, he plays a fish out of water. He's like, you know, beamed into the future, and he goes to the bathroom, and he comes out and says, there's no toilet paper, and they look around, and they go, he doesn't know what the three seashells is for.
Yeah.
So, of course, now somebody will have to explain what those are for us, I guess. Anyway, my last fact check here is Star Trek canceled. Well, I said it was canceled. Apparently, canceled was not the correct term back then. They were threatening to cancel it out after the second season or during the second season because it initially had high ratings and then kind of like just became a sort of an average show. After the first season, it dropped from the 52nd position down to 94 it dropped to 52nd position out of 94 programs. So NBC was not happy with that and threatened to cancel the show. And of course, like, the word got out, and fans of the show, led by one guy named Beau Trimble, he started a letter writing campaign for the first time because it says it was unprecedented.
Mm.
They basically got the network to keep the show on the air for at least almost another season. But yeah, that was a famous story about Star Trek being, like, it was the letter writing campaign that brought it back to life.
Not really the first Twitter.
That's how you did Twitter. You just basically shamed the office into thinking it was a bigger deal than maybe it was. I don't know.
We used to say that the newspaper, if somebody takes the time to write a letter, they're not representing one person. They're probably representing a dozen at least, right?
You think?
I think that's the idea, is that, you know, most people would be irate but wouldn't write a letter. Nowadays, of course, people just pull out their phone and off they go. So it's easier to get a real gauge of how they're reacting to things. But back in the day, if somebody took the time to write a letter to the editor, they meant it.
Right. Took effort.
Took out their personal stationery.
Right. Put a stamp on
sat
it.
Sat down at their Smith Corona, you know, like it was a serious deal.
Started melting down the wax.
That's right.
Got their ring
right.
ready.
That's right. They had to get a raven had to bring it. I mean, it was a whole production.
My dad used to write letters to the editor. Anyway. All right, cool. Move on to the headlines.
Headlines. Time to have jingles on this show. I will kick us off on headlines tonight, and I'll kick us off with a bang. So this came out yesterday. We're going to see Wonder Woman 1984 this year, after all. Oh, wait.
In theaters.
Oh, wait. Maybe we are or we aren't, so we'll get into that. So Wonder Woman 1984, the long-delayed sequel to the very much successful Wonder Woman film, is coming out on Christmas Day. Warner Brothers announced that it is debuting on HBO Max on December 25th, and it'll also be opening in U.S. movie theaters the same time. Internationally, where HBO Max
does
not exist.
You get butter on your COVID when you go to the theater?
Uh-huh. Internationally, it's going to be premiering in cinemas a week earlier on December 16th. Now, for the purposes of box office, Canada qualifies as domestic, not international.
Ooh.
So, theoretically, it is opening here in Canada on the Christmas Day, but we also don't have HBO Max. So.
We also don't have theaters open on Christmas Day.
Well, that's for debate, depending on, of course, where you live. But the bigger issue is if it's not available because our theaters are closed and there hasn't been any clarity on whether or not it will be appearing anything up here, it does lead the mind to wonder, will this be picked up by Crave with HBO? How is this going to appear?
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So no immediate answers to that. I haven't seen any. I looked around today to see if I could find any comments. I imagine that there will probably be a lot of questions being asked in the wake of this. This is obviously, this just came out last night. But yeah, I mean, this is, we've been talking over the course of our season about how all these different dominoes have fallen and, you know, the move to put Mulan on Disney Plus, some of the decisions that are being made. This is the biggest one so far, by far, to go to a streaming service. Now, obviously, Warner Brothers and its parent company, AT&T, are wagering that a movie with this kind of star power and fan base will lure people to subscribe to HBO Max, and that it's probably the closest thing they can come to trying to recoup the sales. But this had potential to be a billion-dollar movie. It cost $200 million to make, and given its success of its previous film and the overall fan satisfaction with that franchise, it was probably a solid bet to make at least $1 billion. And to make the decision to give people the window to watch it at home and to pay a minimal amount to subscribe to HBO Max to do that is a pretty milestone decision. So, I guess I'm going to throw this one to Jaime first, as our designated American. Would this be enough to entice you to HBO Max?
Yeah, so my significant other and I were talking about this when I said yesterday, I was like, oh my gosh, it's coming on Christmas, and we saw the trailer and confirmed, like, and it's not an extra price. It's not like what Disney decided to do with Mulan of like, oh, it's like you're paying for like the ticket. You would have gone to the movie theaters. It looks like HBO Max is probably trying to really, really kickstart their whole, you know, subscriber base. So, you know, this is an incentive for people to subscribe. And we've been building a little catalog of like, oh, we need to watch this. Oh, we need to watch that. We need to watch this other thing. And this is one of those ones of like, oh yeah, that probably means in the Christmas time frame, maybe not necessarily Christmas Day, but you know, this winter holiday, we're definitely going to be subscribing for at least a month, binge through everything, watch Wonder Woman 1984. So I think it's job well done. I mean, it's really up to HBO to like, okay, you got me to stick around for 1 month. Can you do it for two? Can you do it for three? Four? I mean, just keep having that good content and we'll continue subscribing, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's sort of what I want out of what they're doing here.
Well, and the word is that it is only going to have a limited run on HBO Max too. It's not just going to be ad infinitum. It's there for a month.
And I missed that part. So there's definitely a ticking clock on the don't wait around to do it.
Yeah. So it sounds like they're going to put it on there. It's sort of as an enticement. Obviously, their timing is deliberate. They're going to put it out there over the holiday season when a lot of people will be at home. A lot of people will have some time. So the window is very strong for them. But I think the goal is we'll put it there to entice people in. And then hopefully they'll fall in love with more of the good content we have there. And then they'll continue to stay with the service, at which point they'll pull Wonder Woman 1984 off and probably put it onto the on-demands, the streaming, the iTunes store and all the traditional money-making venues. You can purchase a copy and own it, all those other things. So yeah, it's... I don't know. It's a big move. I mean, you know, they're not going to make $1 billion. There's no math that works out that way. So This as a canary in the coal mine, in the same way that Tenet was and that Mulan was, you know, let's put Tenet out in the theater and see how we do. Well, the answer is okay. Not good, not great. Okay. Mulan went to Disney Plus. We don't have strict figures on that, I don't think. But I think there were certainly some people who, you know, felt like that was worth it. This one, I don't know. I mean, it's essentially a lost leader now. It's a real enticement. I mean, this is a good franchise and, you know, it looks like a good film. $15 will get you a month's worth. As Jaime points out, you'll be able to watch, you know, that plus, you know, Westworld and Game of Thrones and all the other HBO content if you're so into it. But will it be enough to keep people sticking around that content? I don't know.
Yeah, the timing for them is going to be keep you around just long enough that it will expire and therefore require you to continue the subscription for the beginning of the Justice League movies on HBO Max or four-parter on HBO Max, right?
Yeah.
Get you into that first or maybe overlap at most with the first part of that of like, you saw that thing, subscribe for another month and get the rest of the movie.
Yeah, and obviously there's always good stuff in the pipeline. We'll talk more about that in our headlines. There's some more good content coming to HBO Max. And there is some, you know, stuff coming down the line. They are in development of a new Game of Thrones series. There is other stuff in the pipeline, but you know, HBO is a very measured, always has been a very measured company. They always, you know, it's not like they just churn out stuff. There's always good stuff coming, but it doesn't exactly come quickly. Westworld does one season every 2 years and the seasons are pretty brief. You know, they're working on a Game of Thrones prequel, but again, it could still be a ways off, especially given COVID. So it's not like they've suddenly going to have, you know, all these things to keep luring people in. They really have to sort of entice people with their back catalog and then the promise of more stuff as it sort of dribbles out.
But by the same token, though, they're also putting bums in seats, which is the thing, which is the whole goal of a movie in the first place, right? And they've had this Wonder Woman movie sitting ready to go for months and months and months, and it must be just burning the investors' butts about not getting it out there in front of people. And it, you know, I think that HBO Max probably has a big enough audience that whatever share they're getting per view is worthwhile, right, for them, right?
I mean, they must obviously they've done the math 6 ways from Sunday to see what is the thing that will make us, you know, make this the most valuable property it can be in the time frame we have. I mean, the reality was like, what were they going to do? Sit on it till 2022 and hope that it is then suddenly worth the $1 billion that they're holding on to it for? You could make a case that people will have, you know, over the course of that time, there'll be an attrition too. People would care less. So it's tricky. And they also, I mean, they got kind of caught up in their own web too, because they had anticipated that they would be able to get things back and going by this fall winter. So there's been this huge advertising blitz. You know, Gal Gadot is on the front cover of a bunch of magazines. And, you know, she's been out, you know, she's on like, you know, all these different things, you know, all that stuff. You got to strike while the iron's hot, right? You know, like GQ's not going to do another front cover interview with Gal Gadot next year just because they've got Wonder Woman coming out again. Like it's a tricky, tricky thing. The timing, the marketing machine behind these things is a challenging thing. And especially it's finite. Like you can only do so much, right?
Well, and they would have been shopping this around. I mean, they can't go to Disney with it because it's a DC property, right? But they might have gone to Netflix. They might have gone to Amazon. They probably went to HBO, obviously, but they probably went and got the best deal they could, considering what they have, right? And I'm sure HBO Max is looking at this as a win for them too, though, right?
Well, I mean, again, it keeps it in-house, right? It's the same thing that Disney did. It basically says, okay, we've got our own platform. We need eyes on that platform. We need bums and seats watching that. So let's do that.
So this is a brown dollar project, like this HBO and DC are together?
Yes. AT&T owns HBO and AT&T owns Warner Brothers.
Right. Okay, that makes... Well, then forget about shopping it around thing, because, you know, this is their home, right?
Yeah, I didn't put it into our headlines this week, but there was a few stories going around, and this is all purely rumor, but there was a rumor going around last week that the producers of No Time to Die, the James Bond movie that we referenced earlier, have been shopping that around because they also have realized that there's only so long you can have those things sitting on a shelf. There was a rumor that they were shopping it to, you know, the Netflixes and the Amazon Primes and everything else. Whether or not that materializes or they finally hit a point of desperation. The thing is, the money is sunk, right? Like, that's the problem. The money is sunk. The producers put up, you know, $200 million or $150 million to produce a movie. The money is sunk. They're not seeing a dime back until that money starts making, movie starts making money again.
Yep.
So some investors are like, fine, I don't care. I don't need my $5 million investment or my $20 or my $100 million investment back. We can survive. Some can't. They want their money back and they have contracts and they want what they want. And so they don't care if you have to sell it for $500 million to Netflix or Amazon to get their money back. They want their money back. So these ones where it's inside these, you know, ecosystems where, you know, the movie is made, they have a platform to launch it. Obviously, those ones make a lot of sense. But for, you know, the ones that are you know, not affiliated like the Bond franchises, that's a tough thing. You know, you are going to end up with, you know, some hard, hard decisions to make.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move on to the Marvel universe.
Yeah, I'll try and pound through these ones really quickly. We knew that we were getting another Thor movie that was already out there, but interesting to know that they were going to get another star in the next Thor movie. So we knew we were getting Thor Love and Thunder, and we knew Chris Hemsworth was going to come back as the titular Thor. We got news this week, Chris Pratt is going to be rejoining, teaming up with his fellow Chris. And
he's going to be Star-Lord again?
He's going to be Star-Lord again. So at the end of Avengers Endgame, Thor sort of heads off into the galaxy as the, you know, he's jokingly the Asgardians of the galaxy. He is, you know, off to have these, you know, new adventures and is leaving with the Guardians of the Galaxy. We know that we're going to have to wait a little while to see Guardians of the Galaxy 3 because James Gunn was working on Suicide Squad 2. So it makes sense that they can sneak a little Chris Pratt in there, give people a little Guardians of the Galaxy sampler platter and you know, wet people's whistles while they're waiting for Guardians 3. But yeah, nice to see him back in his Star-Lord character. And next up, speaking of Suicide Squad, good little teaser this week. We found out that Rocky's joining the Suicide Squad. Sylvester Stallone is apparently going to be in the Suicide Squad movie.
The Expendable Squad?
Now? Yeah, made by the aforementioned James Gunn. They have not said what character he's playing, though, leading to some speculation that he could be the voice of King Shark, the big, giant, anthropomorphized shark monster character, which would probably make sense. I could see that, because he hasn't been spotted, you know, obviously filming anything, so we haven't seen him around, so that makes sense that he would be that. But, yeah, another big star. This movie's already got a lot of star power. It's got, you know, Margot Robbie and Joel Kinnaman and, of course, you know, Idris Elba's joined, Nathan Fillion, John Cena. So, yeah, add another star to the pile.
Cool. All right. My one is you were just talking about the potential earnings or whatever. We don't know, blah, blah, blah. Disney has, in fact, revealed the updated subscriber numbers for Disney Plus and for Hulu, surprisingly. So it's quite big. They claim they've reached 73 million paid subscribers as of October 3rd. And Hulu has 36 million subscribers. So it's quite a large number. We have no idea how many people are using Netflix or Amazon Prime for that matter. Obviously the numbers are big in terms of people watching these shows, right? So, this is, you know, things like The Mandalorian and WandaVision all gain from this, right?
Mm-hmm.
As well as Hamilton. I keep forgetting about High Man is Hamilton, right?
Speaking of Pixar holiday plans.
Yeah, speaking of holiday plans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they were very pleased, it says, with the performance of how Mulan performed at the $30 rental. So that obviously did score well with people in terms of, you know, home buyers or whatever.
Yeah, it would be really interesting. I wish more, as you say, more companies were transparent with those numbers. Trek's going to be really interesting to compare, of course, to see how that ranks against a Netflix, an Amazon Prime, how those audiences rank.
Oh, it does say that Netflix has 195 million global subscribers last month. So we do have a number for them.
Yeah, so considering the time frame, obviously Netflix has a large lead in being able to build that, but that's still a pretty impressive number for Disney Plus so quickly.
That's a lot of discs to mail. But I mean, what is it, like $15 a month for a Netflix account kind of thing?
Well, we talked about that. Obviously, there's tiers, right? You can get them as low as $8 and then as high as, I think, 20-ish, depending on what you're in for.
So even if you took the middle number and multiplied it by a million, you end up with an American building, you know?
Yeah, I like the numbers, though, for Disney Plus. I mean, they've got a good penetration point, but then they started out marketing really low, too, right? Like, their cost per month is $7, $8. Plus, you can get, like, year-long discounts and stuff like that. Like, for the content value, it's pretty high. For what you're getting for what you're spending, it's a definitely very high return on investment. I pay more than double that for Netflix, and certainly their catalog is more impressive just because they've had more time at it as far as unique content. But as far as back catalog, frankly, I think Disney Plus might actually have gotten past them just because over the years, Netflix has obviously lost its leverage in being able to have exclusives and so much stuff. They lost some to Disney. They lost some to the other providers. So yeah, I think, yeah.
Alrighty. Jaime, you're up.
Yeah, so apparently Space Force, the comedy series that Netflix has starring Steve Carell, has been renewed for a season two. Mm-hmm. And this article says, at an awkward moment, because as we record, there is a president-elect Biden. Keep tabs on what ends up happening there. There's too much to go into for this particular show. But given that the premise of Space Force is that it's under the President Trump administration, which started a real Space Force, and this is supposed to be in there, it seems a little awkward, but I've reconciled this in my head to be kind of like Breaking Bad, that by the time the show actually finished, it was well beyond the real world, like 2007, 2008, when it started, right? So that's how I think, like, oh, we're still watching what ended up taking place in the year that this series takes place.
And we know that Lower Decks Tony Newsom is one of the characters in this show.
Mm-hmm.
He's his pilot, or his helicopter pilot.
Now, Tim, I know you watched it. Did you watch it as well, Jaime?
I did.
And what did you guys both think of it? I haven't had a chance to sit down with it yet. Is it worthy of a season two?
It was okay. It was okay. It's sort of very Steve Carell kind of humor, you know. It wasn't like a
modern day Kelsey Grammer.
Well, it was funny. I mean, it was worth watching and worth sort of seeing the story. I think it kind of ended on a bit of a cliffhanger, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's true. That's true.
But you know, not surprising. But kind of based on the current administration, you know, it was, you know, kind of farcical that way, right? Mm. So
yeah, I think the story is okay. The really real reason to watch it is for John Malkovich and Steve Carell. Mm-hmm. I think they're sort of the main ones that you're really going to want to watch for. They do make the best with the stuff that they've got. I think it's like a B-minus series, you know, maybe C+. Mm-hmm. It's not terrible. I don't think
it's a little better than the one that Hugh Laurie did, right? Did you watch that one?
I watched the first couple episodes of that. I must admit it never got me. I walked away and never looked back.
Yeah.
Avenue something?
Avenue, yes. Avenue Space, whatever. Yeah. Avenue 5, I think. It was sort of a, you know, I mean, the story had been done before. It's, you know, Space 1999 meets, you know, a little bit of Fifth Element, but the cruise part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Space Force is funny. It had some awkward, you know, slapsticky kind of moments, you know, where the technology gets in the way of the people. I don't know if you remember the Cone of Silence from Get Smart.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of, you know, silliness.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, which they did really well, those guys.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. I think we may have talked about the PS4 having Apple TV before. Have we talked about that? Because what caught my eye here was the PS5
coming out. I don't know that the PS4 had Apple TV before. I don't recall it. I mean, it's never been necessary for me. I have both an Apple TV device and also I have Samsung-enabled TVs that have that built in. So,
right.
So I can't say sure, but I don't recall it. I don't recall seeing it.
Yeah, so it's a better... it's a good move for Apple, and it's a good move for Sony in that sense to have have it available, because I think we talked about PlayStation TV didn't really go very far, right?
No.
And I think I've mentioned before that what I like about my Apple TV is that it marries my Prime account and my Netflix account and my Disney account mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff together. So I just have one place to go, and it automatically fires up whatever app. This is a little different than the Apple TV itself, because the Apple TV is, you know, the Apple TV device runs a sort of an iOS and or tvOS it's called, but this is the app, I guess, has been ported over to the PlayStation platform, so you can watch your Apple TV content right on the device, right? So you've got your system with your fancy 4K or whatever 27K TV, right? You can watch your PlayStation, or you can watch Apple TV stuff on your PlayStation 5, but they're also, as we're saying, it's now available for download on PlayStation 4 and 5, so that's why I wasn't sure if we had talked about this on the 4 before.
Yeah, I noticed it when we were loading up the 5, it gives you a recommendation of sort of initial apps you may want to download, mm-hmm. and Apple TV came up as one of the apps that you may want to download alongside Netflix, and can't recall if Prime was there, but there was a few that sort of popped up as these are ones you may want to start with, and of course you can add more apps, but it caught my eye for sure, because I don't recall seeing an Apple-enabled app on a Sony device before like that. And yeah, you're right, it makes perfect sense. Obviously, if they want this to be sort of your entertainment device hub, where you sort of, you know, have a lot of different things. I think YouTube was one of the ones as well. It makes sense. It makes sense that a lot of people use it in that form, right? Especially if you have an older television set that isn't capable of using that. A lot of people are going that route.
But this is just the TV portion. It's not the same as an Apple TV, no. which, you know, lets you run multiple apps and games and things. But
no.
this is the TV app, which is used for consuming media.
Yeah.
And of course, it does mention here that it's a $4.99 US a month subscription, but if you buy iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV or a Mac, you get you can get a free year for it,
yeah.
and which we have done, anyway, so that's good.
And sometimes they'll throw in an extra few months just because.
Well, they did with me, because I started in October, and I guess the content isn't really up to snuff for like, I think they probably saw the writing on the wall. A lot of people would sort of probably jump if it was time, you know.
Yeah, I'm gonna take the Jaime Lopez long view of the Apple TV content to say that, you know, I might pop in if there's something that I can't live without, but so far there's nothing they've produced that I can't live without.
Yeah, you know, yeah, there's no Mandalorian, there's nothing. I've watched probably, I think we talked about it, maybe 75% of the stuff that's relatively new for the show. I've watched, you know, obviously movies and things like that too that I own already, but yeah, I haven't rented any movies or whatever on the Apple TV, so that, you know, I've only ever rented it's the medium popcorn argument sometimes, you know, the price is so cheap to just go and buy the movie that renting it doesn't make sense,
mm-hmm.
you know, unless they do this thing like, you know, like they could do that with say Wonder Woman, that kind of stuff. They could rent it to people on these systems and then not let you buy it until they're ready to release it, right? So they could try that as a model for seeing how much people would buy, right?
Yeah,
in case you're listening, we take a commission, we're not proud, you know. Anyway, Jaime, what do you got for us?
Very quickly is the trailer for Batman Soul of the Dragon, which is coming to Blu-ray and digital in January. This is an animated movie of Batman that is very 1970s. It has got the 70s era kung fu and blaxploitation feel going to it, so could be an interesting one.
Does it have the repeating backgrounds and stuff?
Yeah. No, it's a little higher quality.
Like Scooby-Doo or something running by.
Yeah, for the Flintstones, they run by the same chair 20 times. Yeah.
Have you been keeping up with all the animated DC properties, Jaime? I've watched some, but I've missed the last sort of few. I've been watching some of the Justice League Dark and stuff.
No, I was for a while, and then they just have so many of them, and there's like a handful on Netflix, so I'm really hoping that there is some section of HBO Max or something that just has them all collected the way the MCU is on Disney Plus.
Yeah, I was disappointed because it was a while back. It was probably a good four or five years ago, they switched animation styles. They were doing a lot of the DC Universe stuff was following that sort of Bruce Timm Batman animated series style of animation, and I really liked that. And then they started sort of experimenting where some of the series they were doing adaptations of comic storylines, and some of them they were trying to sort of pay homage to the artists that originally drew it. So they were doing the art style in the style of the artist, and I was okay with that. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And now they've gone to an animated style that is sort of very unusual. It's kind of a hybrid between anime and traditional North American style animation. And I don't love it all the time. Sometimes the stories are good and I'm just fine, but sometimes it catches me and if I'm not enjoying the story as much, I sort of devolve into the minutia and think like, this isn't working. All right. Another piece of good news. The Vertigo series DMZ has been in development with HBO for a little while now, with Ava DuVernay doing the show running on that one. And they announced today that they are going to be on HBO Max. They're going ahead with what they're calling an event series. So it sounds like they're not going to do it as an ongoing. It's not going to be multiple seasons. It sounds like it's going to be, you know, a certain number. Finite number of episodes in the vein of oh goodness, what was that show with all the famous actresses that was on
like Birds of Prey, maybe?
No, I was thinking about the one with Meryl Streep and
Ocean's 8,
Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon. It was on HBO and it was like the same thing. They labeled it as an event series. It was basically like 8 episodes. Pretty Little Liars? No, that's not it. It's something with 3 words.
Mrs. America? No.
Anyway, there are many series that are going this route now, that are basically doing their, you know, event series. They're, instead of doing it's just going to go on and on, they basically do, you know, little bits and pieces. It makes sense for this, although, you know, it ran for, you know, I think 50 or 60 issues in the comic. I wonder if that is going to be a little limiting to the story. But on the bright side of it, Ava DuVernay is a great filmmaker. Rosario Dawson is going to be the star. It sounds like it's similar but not the same premise. The premise of the comic is around a photojournalist who is very raw, and he gets basically embedded on he gets embedded in New York City. Big Little Lies, by the way, is the one that popped into my head. He gets embedded in New York City, which is the demilitarized zone following the second U.S. Civil War, and he is basically trying to survive in this really messed up environment where it's kind of lawless and a little chaotic. In the adaptation that, as they've described in this release today, it is Rosario Dawson is playing this character whose son is trapped in the DMZ, and so she has to basically navigate this very lawless, crazy place. Similar place, but different scenario, where she is now going to go into this place to try and recover her son. So it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. The story of DMZ, the concept is well executed. The idea that you know, the red states, the blue states can't play nice anymore, and it all just sort of devolves into you know, chaos and violence. And then, you know, there are these places where it's sort of the gray area is very well, very well realized in the comic. I'll be very curious to see how well that works on the screen, and I'll also be curious because obviously things are very politically divided south of our Canadian border right now, so it'll be interesting to see how poignant and relevant that could be.
All right, cool.
Another little taste of something that's coming. So there's going to be a new Wonder Girl series coming to the CW. Now, there's been few characters that have been Wonder Girl. So this would be like the junior Wonder Woman. There have been a few Wonder Girls over the years. Most famously, Donna Troy, who was a member of the Teen Titans. And, of course, the new Teen Titans, all those different iterations of that over the years. Was a well-known character and has been spun off into different things in the animated world and other things. This one is really interesting. The reason why I wanted to mention it was because they're actually basing this series around a character that hasn't even debuted yet. So This January, they're doing an event series for DC Comics. DC Comics is basically shutting down all its regular books for the entire month of January, and they're doing this event where they are sort of looking at the future of DC Comics within this sort of one contained event. It's called Future State. And in Future State, they're basically looking at, like, you know, it's basically a reboot of the universe. So I can't recall if we talked about this previously. They were going to do, I'm told, a complete reboot of the DC universe for the umpteenth time. Was in the offing for this year, prior to the DC bloodletting. They were going to do this. Apparently not everybody was happy with it. And the people who were for it have all moved on, and the people who were against it are now the ones in charge. But they had already done all this work. So what they decided to do is basically take those, you know, introductions of the new characters and use this as a giant sort of event thing, and then they're just going to go back to their regular business. But if some of these characters hit, then they'll find ways to work them into DC continuity, I'm sure. So all of that preamble to say, this character that they're introducing in January is going to be the new Wonder Woman. Her name is Yara Flor, F-L-O-R, and she is going to be the new Wonder Woman. Well, that's the character that they're going to base this series for CW that they're developing on, which is a really strange choice. So obviously they're privy to all the possibilities of all these different things and, you know, why it works and why it's different and all these other things, because they already have the work in hand. But it's really interesting choice that they are going to develop a whole series around a character that no one's ever seen before, and then give it a name that people are familiar with to a certain extent, and to root it into the DC universe, which again is sort of right now it's CW's bread and butter. So interesting choices all around.
Yes.
I've stunned you both into silence. I can tell you're in totally engrossed.
No comment.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how they roll with it. I could see why there might be some confusion of like, oh, is it like Superboy where this is young Wonder Woman? And it's not. And I guess having it be the Latinx character is like, well, obviously when you look at the person, they don't look like Gal Gadot. So it's like, oh, okay, it's another person who's younger and has a similar title. Okay, I gotcha. Now, where's the toys, right?
Yep.
Where's the Happy Meals and stuff like that, right? Like, I think that's probably how they're going to roll with it.
Yeah, and it is, I will say, is a good point, Jaime. This article that I've got a link to from Deadline does point out the character is Latina, and she's supposed to be the child of an Amazon warrior and a Brazilian river god who discovers that she has these powers and decides to sort of take up this mantle and everything else. The series is being led by a Latina person, and the lead character is going to obviously be Latina too. So this is obviously all positive that that we're making more progressive steps towards representation across the superhero genre, and that is definitely very commendable. And maybe that's why it was just easier to do it this way, but with a character that people aren't familiar with, that they wouldn't get any of these kind of, you know, nonsensical backlashes of like, oh, Superman's not black, that you can't be black, you know. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that resonates too. And my last bit, Johnny Five is alive. They are remaking Short Circuit. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to feel about it. The original Short Circuit, 1985, a bit cheesy.
A period piece.
Steve Guttenberg, Ali Sheedy, one of the worst racial stereotype Indian characters ever played by a white guy. So that's not good. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't hold up well over the course of time. You can't watch that movie now and be like, oh, this is great. It's heartwarming. You get taken out of it by Fisher Stevens' bad Indian stereotype character pretty fast. And it's even more glaring in Short Circuit 2 because he's the central character along with Johnny Five. And yeah, it's not so good.
Now, just a side note here, a good friend of mine was actually in Short Circuit 2.
There you go. Which it was filmed in Toronto, wasn't it?
At the Eaton
Center. There you go. Yep. This is back before we were Hollywood North too.
Yeah.
So I guess I understand. The concept is in of itself timeless. The idea is that this inanimate thing is brought to life, and you know, it's the Pinocchio story, right? This inanimate thing is brought to life and has these adventures based on the fish out of water, I don't know anything because I was just a robot and now I'm a living thing kind of stuff. So I think you could make this movie 100 times in 100 different similar ways and it would always work. So I completely understand it. And of course, brand recognition, there will be, you know, the parents will take their kids who once saw Short Circuit and yada yada yada, and maybe Steve Guttenberg gets a cameo, and okay, it's fine. But I don't know, it's not high on my list of to-do. I don't know how you guys feel about Short Circuit, the Short Circuit verse.
Yeah, it's it definitely is a bit problematic in the modern era with the Benjamin Jarvie character. I would say that the two movies are pretty interesting. I do hope that they use mostly practical effects for this remake. I don't think it works quite as well when you don't have the physical character there, and the character holds up really well because it was like a puppet and you know, electronics, and now like they could probably have the dang thing mostly self-contained, right? With modern tech. So I hope to go with that. I will say that Short Circuit 2 is pretty traumatic in its ending scenes.
Yeah.
It's just like makes you cry. Like, if you don't know, go watch the movie. It's available on like a bazillion different like free streaming service places. And yeah, I'm not sure how it'll work. I mean, it's not like it will diminish the original that it exists if the remake's not so great, and maybe they can find an approach to it. I'm not 100% certain what angle they'll take for the premise, because Johnny Five, or Number Five in the first one, was a Cold War weapons program item, and he
Operation
was not
got you last.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, you know, he's not even unique in any way. He's the fifth one, and I can't remember how many there were. Maybe there were only five.
Yeah.
So it definitely spoke to a different era, and I wonder if you can have the this machine that's intended to like deliver nukes to take out the Soviets. What will they do? I don't know. Maybe they'll give it like a more modern like anti-terrorist angle or something, and there will be complicated stuff. But so yeah, I kind of wonder about that. I kind of wonder. But you know what? You can kind of update some things, like, you know, originally Iron Man was very heavily tied to the Vietnam War. Is that right? And they've updated the modern Iron Man sort of backstory to have a lot of the same essential themes, but not be as tied to the specific era. So maybe. But the Latinx angle to it made me post the clairvoyant follow up here. It says like, what? They already covered that in Short Circuit 2. There already was a Latinx angle, and the short clip here is where the Hispanic gang has vandalized Johnny Five, and he doesn't even realize that that's what happened.
Not exactly the best representation of the Latino community at all. It's just
it's
worst stereotype of the 1980s. The way they portrayed Latinos in film,
it's very on brand with the Indian face white guy actor sort of thing. So at least it's you know, consistent thematically.
Yeah. So this movie is basically just an apology to the community for the last one.
Yeah.
Can I, just as a quick aside, how do you feel as somebody of that heritage? How are you with the term Latinx?
I'm complicated, and probably because of my age. So I identify with Gen X more closely as being younger Gen X, but apparently they moved the bars on the timeline and said, no, you're actually early older millennial. And I feel like I'd have to be closer to like the true sort of sweet spot of millennial to have it make sense.
Mm.
For a very long time in my life, it was Latino, and I understand the aspect of that not being inclusive, because it is the masculine form of the term, which wouldn't necessarily be inclusive of Latinas, even though to me, again, as a Latino male, I'm like, oh, what's the problem? It's like, well, you don't see the problem because you don't hear it from like it not fitting you. So I understand it from that aspect, but it feels like there should be an alternative term, because it's a very weird term. Like when I read it for the very first time, I was like, so how do I read this? Because it should be like Latinx or something. And I think I've heard people say Latinx. I'm like, but that just puts English at the very end of it.
Yeah.
This feels like a regression in the other direction for a different problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I just find it interesting, because I've seen, obviously, both these stories we just talked through have that presence, and it's certainly starting to become more of the vernacular as sort of a PC term that encapsulates those male and female, and of course gender neutrality and all these different factors. So I get why you want one, but then I've also seen pushback, especially because my job is very deeply in social media, so I'm on there all the time, and some people hate it. They just hate it. So I don't know. I'm curious to see understand if this is something that is a better way to go forward, or if this is just one of those, you know, like it's a stepping stone to where we ought to be.
Yeah, I'm guessing awkward stepping stone. Mm. As folks have, let me spend 30 seconds on this, because again, this is one of those things that I never really had to think about what is the distinction, because all three of these terms actually do apply to me, given my background, Mexican American heritage. So Hispanic is apparently all peoples who have
Spanish-speaking background, which notably does not include, like, the people of Portugal or Portuguese-speaking folks,
or
like
Brazilians. Or, yeah, yeah.
Right? So, you know, Latin America, Mexico, Guatemala, Chile, Argentina, all the, it, probably Spain itself. Latino covers the Latin America heritage, which coincidentally includes a lot of those same people, but also starts lumping in folks like Brazilians, who don't speak Spanish, again, they speak Portuguese, and others. Distinctly does not include the Spaniards, because they're not in Latin America. And then you have Chicano, which is very specific to Mexican heritage, which I do have. So again, for me, like, people are like, oh, which one? I'm like, I don't know, I don't care. Because I knew all three applied, but I never really thought about the actual distinct differences. So talking about the, as happened in the election, is like talking about the Latino vote is kind of like talking about like the Asian vote. Mm-hmm. And then you have to start talking about like, oh, well, you know, that includes India as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and gets really awkward and weird. It's like, okay, we probably need a better term then for, to make this more clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Let's get hyped.
Yeah. On brand for the well-timed Wonder Woman 1984 on HBO Max is the official teaser update to Justice League Director's Cut. And we should get super hyped. We don't have a date. I highly suspect it will be just very interestingly timed after the Wonder Woman 1984 month subscriptions end, right? Either overlapping so that you get the first part of the director's cut of the four part, for those who don't remember, or none at all. And then, haha, we got you to subscribe for another month sort of thing. And it's definitely going to be a completely different movie. The tone is so different. You see characters like Darkseid, which is roughly the DC Thanos, or Thanos is the DC, sorry, the Marvel Darkseid, and other stuff like Cyborg's dad going all Mr. Manhattan, or Dr. Manhattan, and like disintegrating and all sorts of weird, cool stuff that looks like a lot going on.
Yeah, it cool. looks good. And then there was a little tease this week. They said that there's only going to be about 4 or 5 minutes of brand new shot content that's going to be added to it. A lot of it is just updating visual effects that were never finished, and then repiecing the
isn't maybe like 6 hours long or something like that,
or plus. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And apparently it also, again, take this with a grain of salt, these are all, you know, blogosphere rumors, but there is word that it does very neatly set up a sequel.
All right. Well, that's it, folks. We're at the part of the show where we talk about Star Trek Discovery Season 3, Episode 6, Scavengers. And this time, Jaime is going to do the recap. So take it away, Jaime.
Yeah. So we start off with a beautiful scene of the USS Discovery getting a refit or retrofit, depending on how you think about that, with new cool technology, such as the disconnected warp nacelles that they had noticed on, in a previous episode on the Voyager J, and other tech, but also a dash A designation on the Disco. I don't know if we want to talk about that now, or if we want to talk about that as later in the recap.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. The decision to consider that a brand new version of the ship, so much so that it's got a new designation. Get into the history of the A's?
I mean, there's going to be a new model kit.
Do we need to get into the history of the designation A and why it's used and what it means? Again, sometimes it means it's a brand new ship. Sometimes it means it's a retrofit, right?
Does it? Oh, okay.
Well, the only there have been renames of like the USS Yorktown becoming the Enterprise A, or the Sao Paulo becoming the USS Defiant. Mm-hmm. It didn't get marked as A because of money to change an actual model, but it's effectively an A. There have been new, you know, dash letters like the Enterprise D, B, and C, and others.
It's because Kirk blew them up, though, right?
Yeah, and
this so is it's why we can't like, have nice things.
Usually an honor thing, I think, and I'm surprised that they didn't cover this in the episode, that you either have the more realistic take, which is, well, the Discovery is supposed to have been lost many, many years ago, and it's kind of weird to have this old ship hanging around, so let's just pretend it's a new ship with in honor of that original ship, right? And that way it won't be quite as weird of a story to cover with the time timey-wimey stuff. Or you go the I don't know if they have this television show in Canada, so I apologize. You go the this old house route, where sometimes they leave nothing but the fireplace, and and they've built an entire new dang house and pretend that it's you know, an upgrade to an existing house.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes, we know who Norm Abrams is and Bob Vila and those guys.
I suspect that maybe he was Canadian or something, you know, because like
secret Canadians are
everywhere, but I wasn't sure. He wore a lot of flannel.
Yeah. Yep. From New England. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. So we get into Saru speeching and meeting with the Admiral and presumed senior staff for the Admiral, talking about, you know, Discovery's been spending, you know, a few weeks getting, you know, retrofit, and the crew is getting retrained and learning, you know, new stuff about what they've missed and what's going on. And it goes into a sort of a situation room for the Admiral of like, okay, well, this ship needs to go over here to take care of this problem. And, oh, there's bad things going on in a neighborhood over here, so this ship isn't going to go over there. And Saru's like, yo, you know, dilithium is hard to come by after the burn, and, you know, we can just be there instantaneously and go through this really fast. And Adam's like, I understand your enthusiasm. However, you're our fast responder, and we want to just save you for, like, real critical situations, right, where we actually need your speed, not because it's convenient, right? I don't want you off doing something else completely out of communication and then coming back and, whoops, we sure could have used you for the actual emergency that come up, right? That I think it's going to be an interesting balance here for the Discovery, where they're the, like, the emergency firefighters and not the, you know, let's go see what's happening. Let's take this, you know, this bride, this mail order bride, and deliver it to this ambassador somewhere, right? It's going to be like, no, this is for truly critical situations.
Yeah, and I think it's going to lead to some interesting quandaries for the ship. It was a science vessel, right? Like, they say that explicitly in the previous episode. We're a science vessel. We're explorers. We are, you know, used to mystery, solving mysteries and figuring out new things and all that stuff. This puts them, you're in exactly right, Jaime. It puts them in the position of being completely the opposite of that.
Yeah, and from previous episodes where I said that I watched Discovery on the broadcast to see what that was like on CBS, I was reminded of the fact, and they haven't talked about this as much in season 2 or season 3, but Stamets was really angry that he's like, I'm a scientist, why am I being drafted into this war to use my technology for fighting, right? And so I wonder if they might come back to that approach of like, I thought we were a science vessel, why the heck are we going out and firefighting here? Why are we blowing stuff up? Why are we doing, you know, probably shady things they're going to have to do in the future versus why don't we go out and explore?
Yeah, I think it does set up an interesting just internal conflict, the idea that they are now the opposite of what they intended themselves to be.
Right. So we hear about Osira and the Emerald Chain are apparently causing trouble in some neighborhood. I didn't write the notes on
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
Atlanta, come on.
With Will Smith. Then we see that the Disco crew has gotten those new cool badges that are just like the all-in-one Swiss Army knife that's got the holographic pad and communicators, which actually, you know, we saw from TNG era. Tricorders built in and personal transporters built in. It's just like an all-in-one sort of thing.
So I gotta say, the orientation of this new crew is like really bad in the future. They just throw them new tools and expect them to know exactly how to use them in dangerous situations and stuff. So
yeah, I think I got more training on how to use Microsoft Teams than they got to use the personal transporters. Yeah.
Or the comms, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah. I think if this was Lower Decks, they definitely would play that for like, oh, you know, I'm gonna leave for dramatic effect, and then well, I guess that wasn't the transporter, but hey, you know, that medical problem you had is going away, so well done on that, you know. Yeah. And we see that the other parts of the ship have gotten upgraded internally as well, and that the consoles for the con and navigation have the programmable matter that you interact with, still using a very similar design to keep the Discovery crew like not too bent out of shape of how different it is, and the apparently holographic interface will just adjust to whatever you need, so it's not a generic user interface. It is literally whatever makes sense for you personally. And you see, like, I forget his name, but the weapons officer, Reese. I want to say his name is.
Yes.
You know, takes a little like model of the ship and sort of moves it around. So you can see that tactical has some interesting uses there.
Yeah, I think it was you last week, Jaime, that called it the Minority Report stuff. It's very much so. It feels like you know, move this with your hand, twist this, do that. Definitely has that feel.
Yeah. And speaking of the personal transporters, the alien engineer or ops, I can't remember what he is, science scientist or something, Linus accidentally beams himself into the captain's chair instead of the mess hall where he wanted to be, which at this time in my notes I put, damn liar, like you just wanted to pretend and go sit in that captain's chair, and this is your opportunity to fake it without getting, you know, reprimanded for it.
Yeah, Linus always gets the best cameos.
Yeah. And then we see a different scene where there's a hologram of Book talking about the finding a black box that he's been able to find. It's over in the Bajoran Exchange. Apparently these black boxes come from destroyed Burn ships. But Michael says, hey, if the Burn happened simultaneously everywhere at once, all of those ships should have been destroyed at the same exact microsecond. But she's already gotten two in the past year when she was sort of traveling around without the disco. And it's slightly off, which implies that there might be an origin from which the Burn emanated from, right? Mm. Idea being that the closer you were to the Burn, the earlier in time that the explosions would have happened for you, as opposed to as you were further away in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So now,
isn't the cat driving the ship at that point?
Well, the cat is the only occupant of the ship anyways.
Was that come later? Or?
No, that's the scene. Grudge shows up in Book's ship, and that's where they get the data download about the black boxes.
Yeah, I don't think we talked about the cat. Right?
No, we didn't talk about the cute scene with the cat on the view screen. Grudge is the cat's name. Grudge come up later.
Yeah.
So Michael wants to go, you know, help Book, and Saru's like, look, I understand what you're trying to do here, but like, you can't do this, right? We need you here to follow orders, and we have a particular mission that we need, and Discovery might be told to go, you know, take care of one of those neighborhood problems, the first responder, and we can't have the Discovery just going out there without its commander, without its, you know, number one, its first officer. So of course Michael goes immediately to Giorgio, who's like, hey, here's this thing I want to do. She's like, yeah, you already had me at, like, you know, unsanctioned mission, let's just go do it, right? That's your character. So, you know, Michael and Giorgio end up taking Book's ship and heading to the planet Hunhao, and on route Giorgio gets this weird memory or vision, like it's this weird shocking thing that she sees of the Terran Empire logo and her bloody hand and somebody who's wearing, I don't know, like a funeral mask or a Spider-Man mask. I couldn't tell what it was, how quickly and briefly they showed. And she says, San, you know, which I presume was the person's name. And clearly there's a lot of emotion going on there. But this might be what she was encountering when we saw last episode, where she was completely out of it and didn't respond at all to Michael for a good few seconds. That will come up later in the episode of what's going on there. So we see this more than once. So the ship that they're on, Book ship, I can't remember if it has a name, but Book ship arrives at Hunhao. It has a whole bunch of like scrap just sort of around the planet from the Burn. Apparently this is, you know, like this junkyard scrapyard where they do sort of take pieces from these ships and like use it for stuff, right? Use it for the raw materials.
Mm-hmm.
In orbit though, Giorgio's quarreling with a person named Tolar, who is a Orion person, about like, you know, will they allow him on the planet or not? And they go back and forth. She's like, look, bro, like I have real dilithium, so, you know, your boss is gonna be real mad if you don't let me land and trade, right? And that, you know, convinces him, like, all right, let's go for it. And we learned that Book apparently had this cat collar thing for Grudge that he could use to figure out where the cat was, but that Michael has reverse engineered it to do the opposite direction and try to track Book and see where the heck he is.
And it meows.
Yeah, I don't know why it meows, but it does.
So that made me laugh. Both times it went off and it meowed, I laughed.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we do end up with a scene of Tilly going to say hello to Grudge, and Grudge being very cat-like and just having no concept of personal space, climbing all over Tilly until he having to like bend and contort awkwardly until he's like, all right, let's put you back in the box. And nope, as cats do, they like to run under the bed where it's very difficult to get them out from. And we're back on the planet where Talor, who's the nephew of the aforementioned Osira, greets Michael and Giorgio. They're claiming that that Michael is like a slave or subordinate of some fashion to Captain Giorgio. That's their undercover story. And they're walking around looking for old tech, like 24th century self-stealing stem bolts.
Oh, such a great callback. self-sealing stem bolts.
To the No-J Alliance?
Yeah.
Consortium? I forget what they called it, but it was Nog and Jake from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Ended up with a whole load of self-sealing stem bolts. You've got a hand phaser, a Type 2 phaser from the TNG era. Yep. And we do see this Andorian, who we later learn his name, Rin, who's not looking too great. He's got his antenna cut off, or he's missing them, is what we know at the time. And he puts this weird device on a man, and it's like a little button circle implant thing around the nape of the neck.
Didn't they put one of those on R2-D2 and C-3PO and in Star Wars?
it is pretty...
Restraining bolts.
Yeah, restraining bolts.
It is pretty similar. It does make me think, given what we learned of its use case, that it's kind of like, if you've ever seen Battle Royale, it's kind of like those little neck thingies that they wear.
My mind went to Running Man. It was Running Man immediately.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, this is the scene in Running Man where the exact same, it like plays out like it's a shot for shot homage. Yeah.
So of course Book is there, so he's part of the enslaved labor there, picking through all the scrap. And apparently this Bajoran is accused, or, and I believe confesses to stealing a water ration, right? He was just a little thirsty, and he's forced into this sick game for his life, where we learn that those little disc things are part of the security system, where they have this perimeter wall. It's not a physical wall, but it's like an electronic digital wall that if you run out past it will cause the top of your head to be blown clean off by that little implant, which in my notes I wrote that it's kind of like what Anakin Skywalker described in the prequels, where he said they implant this thing in you so you can walk around wherever you want, but if they discover you left, like, they can just blow you up remotely, right? And this happens in that sick game where the Tolor has got his handgun and is told the man, hey, go run, you know we were doing some maintenance, so it might not kill you, but this gun will definitely kill you, so I'm just going to keep shooting to convince you to run out there and make a point of you. And we see Adira back on the disco, and Gray chatting. They're in engineering and talking about how they're, you know, not really getting out and doing much. It seems like Adira's gone very sort of, I would say, internally focused, except they are actually talking to what they perceive to be somebody else. It's still kind of unclear what exactly Gray is. Manifestation, you know, spirits, just a weird way that the symbiont works with a non-Trill host. But nevertheless, you know, Stamets comes in. He's like not happy with the layout changes that have occurred in his section of engineering, given the refit of the disco. And apparently, Adira has done him a real solid. She's like, hey, I've redesigned the spore drive interface, so we don't have to use those weird needle shunt things on your arm. We've got this cool like holographic gel thing that, hey, it also is non-greasy. It leaves no stains like those really good sunblocks.
New and improved with goo.
Yeah. And so we go back to...
It's worth raising. We get our second funny Linus cameo in there too, where he just materializes in the middle of the engineering department and is once again like, stupid self-transporter not taking me where I need to go. So it starts to become a running gag that Linus can't figure out how to work the personal transporter.
So back on the planet, on how Giorgio is asking about the explosion tech, the little like wall tech, and Tolor's like, it's not for sale, it's proprietary. And Giorgio's like, oh, where do you keep the control unit for? He's, oh, that's a secret. She's like, whatever, man, I can tell you keep touching this stupid device in your pocket, you know, so I know it's there. And this gives an opportunity for Michael and Book to reconnect, right? When she's like, slave, go find me this whatever, right? Go give me this piece. And it turns out that he, you know, he has the black box hidden in his cell or quarters wall, I guess. And that the Andorian Rin, who I think now we get his name, was once part of the Emerald Chain, but was trying to rally people to his side of like, hey, we can do better than this, and got stomped on and his antenna cut off in punishment. And now he's basically a lackey, but he's a decent person, right? He's forced into an unfortunate situation that, like, if he doesn't cooperate here with what he's having to do, then he's going to die a very, very slow death. So he's in a no-win scenario. Yep. Back over on the disco, Tilly is leading the team on, you know, understanding the changes, the upgrades, the spore drive, so that they can be ready and prepared if and when they have to use it, and if things go awry. And Saru wants a a little chit chat, a little private chit chat. He talks about, you know, the situation with Michael, figures out that, okay, he's actually gone. Bookship is gone. What the heck's going on? And Tilly is a total narc. It's like, you have to tell the Admiral. And
yeah,
he's a little shocked. And he's just like, look, dude, like, if you don't tell the Admiral and you're explicitly the one who knows and doesn't tell, like, it paints the entire Discovery crew with the same negative brush. So it's a terrible situation, but you have to be the one to tell them that, like, here's what's going on, here's what happened.
It was a strangely, maybe not strangely, but it was a particularly astute observation from Tilly, who is not necessarily known for those kind of astute moments. But I think it speaks to her relationship with Michael too. Like, she has a complicated relationship with Michael too.
Yeah, and I think it shows some of her growth from being the really naive cadet from the very first part of season one. And when she says, I think if I was in Michael's situation, I would have made the same choice. And Saru is like, I don't think you would have, right? I think you're a very different person than Michael, that you might have, your heart might have been wanting to do it, but I don't think you would have actually done it.
Yeah.
So distractions have occurred in the junkyard. And so Tolar has to leave Giorgio and Michael alone for a while. He's like, whatever, just have the drone watch them, right? At least have somebody observing them. Well, during this time, they walk over into this little area pretending that they're looking for tritanium. Michael picks up this metal piece in the drone analyzes, like, that's not tritanium, and then immediately gets bashed by Michael, who just, you know, hacks it to bits.
I wrote it down as drone pinata.
Yeah, that's essentially what it was, just floating in there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Book and Rin take this opportunity to plot to leave. Like, you know, do you think you can convince people that, like, these folks are coming to save us? They're going to be able to shut off the wall and we can all run out of here. And Giorgio makes a little device out of the scrap pieces there. And we end up switching back over to the Starfleet base, where Saru eats so much crap in front of the Admiral as he has to explain what ended up happening here, right? This is a terrible situation to be in as a leader where, hey, let me tell you about this terrible thing that happened under my command.
Yeah. I think anybody who's ever had to manage people understands that moment of, well, my team member did this, but I'm the one who's going to have to eat the crap burger.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, stuff happens on the planet, in the junkyard. Tolar takes Michael and Giorgio captive. They're over in the little, like, you know, control center area. And this is the opportunity for Book to lead the charge of, like, hey, we can leave now. Like, we got to go stop, you know, Viva la Revolution sort of thing. And Michael and Giorgio, like, fight the captors. But, oh no, Giorgio has another one of those visions where she's just, like, it's in a trance or stuck PTSD style. And this is while Michael is getting the life choked out of her. She's like, get the stupid control, help me out here. Eventually, she does come back to her senses. She just, you know, kicks Tolar and steals the device to turn off the perimeter wall. You've got Rin out the door, taking one for the team, pushing Book out of the way and getting in shot himself. But Michael and Giorgio pilot Book's ship in to save the day, and they pew 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 all the guards as best they can, and they beam Rin and Book on board. Giorgio takes this opportunity to blast the old ships, like Miranda class ships and Hiawatha class ships that were, like, hovering above the camp, so that they crash in and destroy, you know, that little camp / junkyard there, and then they warp the heck out of there.
I did like that she felt the need to use the 1980s action movie punchline. Line, salvage this.
And you've got Book giving Michael the black box. He's like, you know, here's what we came here for.
Which is not a box. It was a tube. I mean, what the heck?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in commercial aircraft here in the 2020s, they're not black either. They're like bright orange. They're meant to be easily found. Yeah. At least they are box shape. I will give them that. This one is more like a tube. Michael goes over to Giorgio. He's like, yo, what's up? What happened there was not cool. What's going on? And Giorgio, you know, explains, like, hey, you know, she's had this problem, been for a couple weeks. And Michael's like, why didn't you tell me, like, we could help you? And I was like, you will not tell anyone here this is going on. And Michael's like, look, this isn't the Terran universe. Having a weakness isn't, you know, the kiss of death for you. This isn't, like, you can get help from people. But clearly they're at an impasse there as to what to deal with and how to deal with this situation. There's a bit of a rift there between them, the lack of trust given them. that like Giorgio throws in your face. They're like, hey, there was another Michael Burnham who told me some things and they betrayed me. Right. So it's rough. They've got a very complicated sort of mother-daughter relationship between these two characters that I'm sure will get explored in future episodes. Mm-hmm. We're over in the mess hall now, where Stamets sees Adira talking to themselves, but they're actually not. They're talking to Gray, and they have some, you know, pretty good conversation, and Stamets sort of takes it all in stride. They're like, oh yeah, so my boyfriend Gray, they're not actually gone. It's who I got the Trill symbiont from. And he's, I mean, it's unstated, but he essentially says, we're on a mushroom ship. You don't have to explain to me. I just take your word for it.
Yeah. And my partner was dead and now isn't dead. And I've seen all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. And also Adira is like helpful here. She's like, hey, we can remove those implants, like the new interface. You won't need those weird things in your arms anymore. Apparently Rin is okay. He's in sick bay, and this gives Book and Michael a little chance to talk, and they go over to the turbo lift. He stops the turbo lift and they have a little tender moment, which for the running gag, Linus beams in again. I can't remember where he was trying to go, but obviously it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And he beams out and they do something that I didn't expect them to do. I thought this was the trope of will they, won't they? Okay, this breaks the tension. They won't. But no, they actually do have the kiss.
Yeah, it was well played.
Romantic kiss here. Yeah. So they subverted my expectation because I thought they were leaning into the trope there with mm-hmm. Linus. Mm-hmm. In a different tender moment, Culber and Stamets talk about Adira and what's going on there, and like, hey, this person who's all about work, does that kind of remind you of anyone? And you've got the whole situation of like, you know, I know what it was like to lose somebody who's not really gone, because as you guys mentioned, that like Culber had died, but he's back, you know, and that's sort of weird that life and death was sort of a non-sequential, non-sort of binary sort of situation. Mm-hmm. We have some more eaten poop where Michael and Saru talk with Admiral Vance, and he just lays it out, and he's like, what am I about to tell you? Which is like very sheepishly, well, there's 100 fires to be putting out every day, and we can't be spending time on figuring out the source of the burn, which let's remind folks, this happened like over 100 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. This is like modern era people trying to solve, like, hey, remember the Spanish flu? We need to solve the source of that. It's like, who cares? We've got our own problems going on right now. Like, it's gone from their perspective, right? You've got, after that, you know, Saru and Michael talk about the situation, and you know what? Saru, as much as he appreciates the, you know, where Michael's heart is and where her talents are useful, but it really comes down to trust, and he can't trust her to be his first officer, his number one. So she is effective immediately. She is demoted to just only chief science officer duties, and Saru, you know, leaves her behind and presumably transports to the disco. And we have the ending scene of Michael taking off her badge, and she just considers. It's implied as to what she's considering, but we're left with just the closing shot of her just considering what she will do next.
Yeah.
I mean, I had trouble with the ending of the show because the whole gee, I'm really sorry, and the, you know, the it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission kind of approach to this, way she and Giorgio run away, and all the, I mean, not that I didn't enjoy the, you know, the pew pew and the running around and the, you know, guy getting his head lasered off and whatever. But the way they handled the ending there, I don't know, you know, we'll leave it up to you to decide your own fate kind of thing, you know, was really hokey, and I don't know.
Yeah. Although I guess I get what the issue was, is that, you know, Vance doesn't want to immediately put all this on Saru when Saru had been very forthright about the certain situation. Right. So mm-hmm. I think he was rightly saying, okay, so Saru, you were up front with me. It's on you to figure out what you want to do about this. And Saru made the right call. And Burnham even says, you made the right call. Like, you're right. I don't deserve to be your number one, because that's not how I'm going to act. All right.
And she is a convicted criminal. I just want to point that out.
Yeah. So I've got four questions, because that seems to be the way these episodes are going now. All right, question one. How did they leave on Book's ship, leave Starfleet headquarters with no one noticing?
Not only did they leave
the ship, they left Discovery. Theoretically, that's where the ship was docked, although we never did see that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until they're like long gone that Tilly's like, where's Burnham? And the computer's like, nope, don't know, can't find Burnham. Where's the ship? Oh, no.
Even
ship.
The ship couldn't come through the impenetrable field until they let it through, right?
Exactly. So how does it leave? So that's a bit of a plot hole.
Well, I was thinking about that. And okay, so getting out of the, like, they didn't really describe the little like starbase hidden thing that, like, yes, it has to be explicitly let in, but I don't know if it needs to let you out.
Yeah.
But it seems like more like
50 ships see you leaving.
Well, so talking about that, I thought from the early episodes that Book's ship has a cloaking device of some sort.
It does. It does. But you think that they still wouldn't be able to like leave the ship and all that area without anything? I don't know. Yeah.
So that's the last part. Getting it out of the shuttle bay is the hardest part. And the only thing you can think of is that like Saru and Tilly rush down to the shuttle bay, pull back the covers, and like, dang it, it's just pillows. How did we lose the damn ship out of here in the shuttle bay?
Yeah. Question two, does this episode successfully undo everything that Michael Burnham has gone through over the past three seasons? So we start out with her being very headstrong and making decisions in her mind for the greater good.
Killing her captain.
But getting her captain killed.
Yeah.
She has all this character evolution over the past couple seasons where she, you know, tries to make better decisions and be a better person, try to be a better friend, all these different things. This episode, pretty much from beginning to end, undoes it all.
Yeah.
And is that a positive? I mean, it's not a positive character development, but what does that do for the character evolution that we've seen?
Well, it's kind of like you wonder now, like Saru, how can he trust her ever again, right?
Well, and he's given her like 1,000 miles of rope over the past three seasons by trying to...
He's a bit of a wuss though too,
right? He is, but then he's tried to help her rehabilitate. He's seen earnestness in her that she wants to be better. But that's true in those previous circumstances. She was trying to play nice with the other kids and was trying to do things the right way. And now she's just undone that. So you're right. The trust is broken between the two of them, but it's also broken between her and Tilly. It's also, you know, like, it feels like it's a humongous backslide. It's like, it's honestly the best allegory that I came up with is being an alcoholic, right? This feels like somebody who had been a raging alcoholic, had gone clean and sober, been sober for, you know, 3 years, and then just went on a humongous bender, and everyone was like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, or the kind of person who can't be happy.
Yeah.
They can't reach that pinnacle of success and just live with that, right? Yep. They have to write their own disaster.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with that. I think I have a different take on it in that it's not undoing. I think of it as an oscillation to figure out who is this person underneath it all, because you have season one Michael, who is only considering like her take, like granted her thoughts are for the greater good, but like, I'm the one who knows, therefore I will just go do it, right? Even if it's not appropriate from like a chain of command sort of thing, or not the official way of doing things. And then by the end of season two, you have Michael Burnham, who's like, I'm going to sacrifice myself, right? I'm going to take one for the team. And they're like, no, the team is going with you, right? You're not doing it alone, sort of thing. And I think for season three, we're getting her going at least early on back towards the season one Michael. But I think they'll adjust back towards a more balanced character, given that she probably will, with Giorgio in her ear, you know, hey, just do whatever it takes. You know, universe isn't fair. We just got to do whatever it takes to get it done. And I think she'll come to see a better balance from like the Saru point of view of like, you got to follow the letter of the law here, right? And you can't just go rogue here, because guess what? We go rogue, bad things happen. Like, we get into a war with Klingons sort of thing. And I think it's kind of like if Captain America and Iron Man, their story arcs over the whole MCU were the same character, right? Where Captain America was completely selfless. And by the end of his journey, he learns to be at least a little bit selfish to bring him towards the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And Iron Man, Tony Stark, was completely selfish, and by the end of his arc learns to be a bit selfless, and that brings him closer to the middle. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what happens with Michael here, and that her arc is within the same character. And so it does seem like you guys mentioned, like the recovering alcoholic who ends up going on a bender, and they backslide on their progress.
Yeah. Well, and that, again, maybe that's what it is. And we know that next week's episode is the one we discussed previously. It's Unification Part 3, right? So maybe a trip to Vulcan will help her gain some perspective, because that's where she grew up. That's her home. Maybe this is a blip, but yeah, it seems like, you know, in the same way that she was, you know, I'm right and what I'm doing is right and I can justify in my mind what was right, is what she's doing now. She's like, well, I need to solve this mystery and whatever it takes. Although you got to make a case that maybe this was a little bit of also, you know, I'm secretly or quietly in love with Book and or infatuated with Book too. Hmm. All right. Question number three, who's going to be the new number one?
Oh, I got mine written down. You guys will have to take my word for it, but I'll let you guys go first.
Tim, who's going to be the new number one?
Based on the number of talking points or talking lines that she had, it's got to be Lieutenant Nilsen, right? Canada's own.
That would be awesome.
No, I think it's probably Tilly.
All right, Jaime?
I went with Lieutenant Nilsen, who I have called Lieutenant Tax Cuts, but who I have, given what I saw with Michael, I'm like, I have renamed into Lieutenant Unfortunate Redshirt, who will fill in the role of Commander First Number, you know, Number One, and then almost assuredly dies before the end of this season, and they will need a new Number One.
Whoa. By the way, I know we didn't talk about this. I know you're joking about this, but there was an article a couple of months ago that said that, you know, there was an expectation there had to be a certain amount of Canadian content in shows done here. Didn't you guys see that
there
article?
Is specifically, if you watch the credits for Discovery, and this is true of many shows, there is a separate casting person for Canada.
Yeah, Canadian casting, yeah.
So
yeah,
they explicitly have to have a certain number of cast members. Now, those can be background players. They can be, you know, people like Sarah, who are obviously do get some speaking roles, but are smaller roles. So, yeah, clearly there is a quota there somewhere. I tend to agree. As much as it would be nice to further develop some of the other characters, or, yeah, have just for the comedy's sake to have it be Tilly or something else, I don't think you're going to go from being an ensign to suddenly being the number one over top of the lieutenants and the commanders and everything else. I think it...
Oh, she's ensign Tilly?
She's ensign, okay. Yeah. He specifically says her rank at one point, and I think that's supposed to remind us that she's still pretty junior. Mm-hmm. I think it makes more sense. Obviously, you know, it could be Detmer, it could be Owo, it could be Reese, but I think Nilsen makes the most sense because she is in that way, as exactly as Jaime just laid it out for us. I think she's the most sort of disposable, so that there's not going to be the hard feelings if Burnham comes back and reclaims her thing. Whereas I think they've made more of an effort to put, you know, Detmer and Owo and some of the other characters, supporting characters, in a little bit more of a position of prominence, where if they were shunted, it would be just weirder.
Yeah, I think given the way that they like to suddenly turn a background character or minor character into the focus of an episode, and that's when they leave the show, either they die like Arium or they go live on the seed ship like Nan did. Trust me, if you've gotten into an episode and it spent like the first 5 to 10 minutes on Nilsen, I'm like, oh yeah, she's gone. Oh, yeah, right?
She's gonna go.
See, Nan could have been number one.
She should have. No, she would have been like the no-brainer choice week ago, but now obviously not. All right, last one. Mm-hmm. Last question. This is the big one, and this has been percolating, and it sort of crystallized for me a little bit this week as she started to get more and more obsessed with this mystery, the same way she was obsessed with the Red Angel stuff last season. Mm-hmm. How possible is it that Burnham or Burnham's mom is deeply connected to the Burn? Burn, Burnham, Burn.
Oh, right. I don't think it's a name association thing, but yeah, maybe it was her. Maybe it was her sending this suit back into the vortex or whatever it was caused the problem,
or right? Who knows what. But it sort of popped into my mind at one point when she was getting really obsessed. I was like, this is reminds me of last season. I was like, what was the big thing last season? Was like, oh, it was revealed that she was actually the Red Angel. I was like, there's got to be a Michael Burnham connection to all this. What would the connection be? And it's like, well, maybe she's the cause of it. Maybe this mystery with her mom. It really just started sort of coming together for me as I started percolating after this episode and writing my notes. I was thinking,
that's true. She did do a Lucy move today. You know, like one of the things that used to bother me about I Love Lucy was when she and Ethel would get into these fixes, you know, and they would basically go out of their way with some half-baked scheme, and you'd end up watching the show and cringing because she's going to get in trouble and Ricky's going to find out and or whatever, or she's going to end up with too many chocolates on the conveyor belt.
That's what I was thinking. Right?
Yeah.
Michael Madley eating all the chocolates on the conveyor belt because there's too many.
So, I mean, that's her and Georgiou, right? And you know, it's sort of like that's the same sort of thing. It's funny. I don't know if you guys watch The Conners at all, but Becky and what's the main character's name?
Who's the main character?
That, England plays. Becky's the blonde daughter and
Darlene. I haven't seen The Conners. So did she take over the main character after Roseanne?
Yeah. They offed the mother, right? But they put her in an airlock and opened the airlock. But they're working in a factory together now, right? And it's literally they're standing side by side in a line, and it's like literally right out of that same episode, except for the fact that there isn't like the mad panic of trying to get all the chocolates in, but they're literally standing right next to each other in this you know, talking to each other during the show and wearing masks and actually not wearing masks. This is really bothers me about this, right? So they've upped the story for COVID. You know, they've got the shields on and whatever, but everybody on the show in the factory doesn't have their mask over their face when they're talking to each other.
Yeah,
like, hello, I can hear you through your mask.
Yeah,
you know,
but then movie stars don't want to not have their faces on TV.
Well, it's the same thing as like every I don't know if you've ever noticed this, Jaime, but like there's always a show where it's like a bazillion below, whether it's Game of Thrones or you know, some Canadian thing where they're up in the Arctic and you know the whole world is collapsing and there's a, you know, comet hitting the earth or whatever, and they've got all the, you know, heavy boots on and the coats on and the gloves on and all that stuff, and they don't have anything on their head.
Like, oh, and every Canadian's watching it going, dude, you're gonna die
in 5 minutes. You're gonna die
fast. They'll be eating you by the end of this episode.
Yeah, but anyway, so coming back to the Burnham self-sabotage kind of style, I mean, she's like Bugs Bunny or Lucy or Wile E. Coyote. She's just, doesn't matter what her scheme is, it's gonna end up in trouble. I mean, yeah, today she pulled it off and stuff like that, but you know, at the end of the day, one of my favorite lines in the movie Hot Fuzz, you know, when Simon Pegg's character meets, you know, Nick Frost, and they have this big shootout in the middle of the movie, and they say, what do we do now? And Simon Pegg's character looks at him and says, paperwork.
Yeah.
We have to go write a court, you know, we have to go account for every single bullet. I mean, that's the part of Starfleet and Star Trek and all that kind of stuff. Like, Kirk and Spock and McCoy ran around the universe, you know, completely disregarding the first directive, right? Or prime directive, and just, you know, interfered and, you know, meddled with and whatever, like, you know, SETI Alpha 5, right? You know, that's, I don't know, it's just that it's just sort of, they cannot leave, like, there's no way. They can't have the Brave New World or, you know, any of these sort of, you know, foundation-y kind of future societies where everybody just, you know, doesn't have to work anymore because we don't need money and blah, 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 right? They have to just, you know, Burnham is going out of her way to make her life miserable or make everybody else's life miserable, right? So I'm surprised that Cyril and those guys didn't have to come and rescue her. Like, that's what I thought was happening when the scene where the ship comes through and it turns sideways and Book and the blue guy are running and trying to get away from the baddies. And all of a sudden you see all this, you know, see this these shots coming and blowing up stuff. First of all, I was thinking, like, who's doing the blowing up or who's doing the shooting? I thought it was Discovery coming to rescue them, you know? Yeah. But what do I know?
Well, it's, again, I think it all basically is a little confounded because we have seen this sort of interesting character growth. And again, Sequel Margaret Green is an amazing actor, and she's done such a great job putting a lot of nuance and development into this character. And the writers have done an excellent job of really making her a very fully realized person. But
yep, the writers are also writing her plot.
She's an F up. Like, she's just keeps doing this stuff. And at a certain point, you know, like, people like that don't get, you know, the opportunities. And you know, maybe she did need the spanking that she got in this episode, but I don't know.
But she didn't get a spanking. That's the thing. Like, she didn't get a spanking. Yeah. She didn't
You go back and be the chief science officer.
Oh yeah, you get to go and do the cool science stuff while, you know, the rest of us run around and fire phasers and stuff.
Yeah.
No, she didn't get the, like, you know, like in Kirk's time, it would have been, you're going to the brig for a month, you know, like
even on Lower Decks, that would have been the case, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, you're going to scrub toilets for a month, right?
Yeah. You know? Well, it'd be interesting to see where they take this over the course of the second half of the season. Obviously, her obsession with the burn is growing. You know, I'm sure the idea is that she's, you know, everything that she'll, all the decisions she'll have made will have become worth it in the end because she'll
Well, now we all have to figure out the burn. That's the deal, yeah. Right? Like, that's the whole, that's the MacGuffin here, right?
The burn plus her mom, right? Like, that's the sort of intertwined mysteries is, you know, why didn't, where is her mom? Her mom was supposed to come back at the same time. They don't know where she is. So again, my mind immediately went to, well, maybe her mom missed the mark and ended up 120 years ago in a pile of dilithium and all went south from there, you know, like, and maybe they have to time travel, get all timey-wimey.
Maybe it was Harry Mudd.
You know, maybe they have to get timey-wimey again and go and, you know, undo what her mom was going to do.
Well, don't forget, time travel is now forbidden.
Yeah, but like that would stop her. I mean, come on.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like the fact that they said it, the fact that they went out of their way to say, you guys are criminals because you're time travelers. Yeah. That's telegraphing, right?
Yeah.
You know, sorry, Pimey, what do you got to say?
Well, I mean, to stitch that all together, because it's like, all right, so how does the short trek Calypso fit in this, and how or where or what do they do with Georgiou? So I leave open the possibility that the Section 31 thing with Georgiou happens here in the future. But if it takes place back in the past, and like, how does she get back? How does the ship get back? All right, bear with me here. So in a very...
Well, what's with all her visions too, right, today?
Yeah, right? I think in a very Marty, it's your kids, Back to the Future 2 style. So they're like, okay, we got to deal with the time suit with Dr. Burnham problem. We've also got this problem that the ship is becoming more sentient. This is not good. So like, all right, we're going to go, you know, Michael's like, all right, I'm going to take this stuff back over into the past or some other place so we can just someplace put things back the way it was supposed to be, but also keep control from getting access to the disco. So we're going to dump it into this nebula that is really well hidden and just tell it that, oh yeah, we're totally coming back. Right? Just believe me, ship. And they just run away, right? They're the ones running running away that the disco can see, you know, going for 3 days, running away. And somewhere in here, while Michael is trying to save the mom, she's going to lose her alternate mom, Georgiou, who, like, in a Thor Ragnarok way, when Thor and Loki are being pulled up by the Bifrosts and are being chased by Hela, and Loki sort of like falls off the side and ends up on that planet. I think that's how Georgiou falls off of Michael and the Red Angel and falls off into the past for reasons. It's the best I got because I can't see how they stitch everything together in this one season.
Why doesn't Georgiou become number one?
Because she's a monster.
Yeah, that would be a tough one because people are already like, you know, this is like Space Hitler.
Well, do they know she's a monster?
Saru knows for sure. Yeah. There's no world in which Saru would do that.
It's so tough because she undermines his authority even more, like explicitly undermines it, whereas Michael at least was sneaky about it.
Yeah, it's funny. They don't mention that in all this, that like, what's the discipline for her?
Yeah, I do think that part of the thing where they could have taken things differently with Michael is if she wanted to, she probably could have been pretty insubordinate with the Admiral too. Like, oh, what do you think I'm going to say? I think what you're going to say is you hardly have any good people as it is, and you can't afford to lose somebody who's as talented as I am, even though we've obviously had this unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you get rid of me. Okay, cool. Good luck getting the disco to run when they see you booting Michael off the ship. All right. Good luck with the team morale and have pizza parties or something, I guess, after that, because what you gonna do, you know, if you turn this into like a real world office, who's got the leverage? I think that Starfleet is in a lot weaker position to argue that, even though they would, of course, want to have the chain of command.
But the flip side of that is, again, she goes into it knowing that she got Saru in trouble and she doesn't want to get him in more trouble. So if she mouths off to the Admiral, that's what happens, right? Then he's like, how the hell did you pick this person to be your number one? What's wrong with you? I question your judgment. Maybe you shouldn't be in charge of the Discovery and be our rapid responders, right? So it does become a pretty, you know, circular thing where she has to just bite her lip and take her crap sandwich.
let's move on to our watch list, shall we?
Ooh, can I do almost all the watch list?
Yeah, you could. Well, we could let Jaime go first, and then you can have all the
beautiful
watch list.
Way better.
Okay. Well, mine is, I don't know, it just tickled my fancy. It is Harry Potter with Guns, extended HD version on YouTube. So this
the
is
the most
from,
American thing I've ever heard.
This is from the Sorcerer's or Philosopher's Stone, depending on the part of the world you're in. It takes scenes from that movie of them using the wands and says, what if those were guns they had instead? And how does this movie still work and hold up? And it is freaking hilarious. And also, in a dark way, kind of true. Like, we know that the wands can hurt and kill people. Mm-hmm. And they just hand it to these little 10-year-olds and say, here you go. Run around with this thing in your hands at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
But we forbid you from using real bullets. Yeah,
that's right.
Oh, man. When I've got the spot in my head of Hermione just coldly taking out Neville Longbottom. In the dark. It's just straight up gangster style, like Samuel L. Jackson would get an award for this sort of thing.
Oh, my goodness.
Right.
All right. I got some fun stuff this week. So, yeah, I kind of I'll try and run through all of it fast. So I'm going to start with the Lego Star Wars Christmas special, because that one is a good starting point for us. It debuted on the 17th of November on Disney Plus. I sat down and watched it with my sons this week. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I will say that it was funny as a Lego Star Wars special. If you're looking for more than that, as far as references to the original Star Wars holiday special for which this has its name, it's very disappointing from that side. Not nearly as over the top. No, only a few references. Like, I was a little disappointed that it didn't.
The holiday special from 77 or 78, whenever it was, that's what the 70s was like.
I concur. I mean,
that's what you could expect. You'd have a really amazing thing happen, and then for the next 2 years, they would do nothing but camp it up and kitsch it up,
yeah.
And yeah, just put them on Donnie and Marie.
Yeah.
And
so again, as a Lego special, and I really enjoy those Lego shows. Foster and I, particularly my youngest son and I, really enjoy watching those together. I think as a Lego special, it's really funny. It's got lots of funny bits. It plays off of, if you have watched previous specials, it plays the characters very similarly. There's some timey-wimey stuff, so you get to see some older characters mixed in with the newer characters, and it's good. It's enjoyable, but it doesn't really pay any kind of homage to the classic holiday special, and I feel like for people like me, that's missing, but it's still definitely worth a watch. I enjoyed it. People will enjoy it. Now, that segues into my next pick, which is this new documentary that is being worked on entitled A Disturbance in the Force. And A Disturbance in the Force is a documentary that's under production right now, and it is how the Star Wars holiday special happened.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So there's a trailer up. We'll have a link in our show notes. It is a documentary that is trying to get to the bottom how and why the infamous Star Wars holiday special happened. And if you watch this, they've actually got interviews with a bunch of the people who were in it and involved with it. And they actually have interviews with people who have long since passed. So Bea Arthur and Harvey Korman and people like that. They actually have them being asked questions. They've assembled all this footage and they're currently working on it. And my understanding is they're going to try and have this out next year. But the trailer is really funny. And some of the behind the scenes stuff is very funny. There's a very funny bit where Harrison Ford is being interviewed on a chat show, and they say, you know, do you remember working on this? And he kind of looks into the camera and he shakes his head, and they say, you know, well, we might have some clips here. And he reaches over and tries to strangle the host, and, you know, like, and playfully, of course, but mm-hmm. You know, it's just so funny that there's been so much disavowing of this. But then they also talk to people who are like, this thing was so of its time, and of course, exactly what you were talking about, Tim.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very much 1970s, and, you know, it's sort of this perfect piece of 1970s kitsch, and there are people who love it. And the fact that it was,
I don't know if I'd say perfect, but
The fact that it was so reviled and never played again, and it became this, like, again, I'm old enough that it was very much one of these bootlegs that was always, you'd see it in the corner of a
yeah, it was hard to get,
a comic show or something, people would have like bootleg VHS copies, including all the commercials and stuff like that. So it was a really this sort of taboo secret, you know, George Lucas doesn't want you to see this kind of thing. And so I'm loving the idea that somebody's finally going to dig into this and do the sort of, you know, comprehensive look at this, you know, horrible, horrible, but incredibly rewatchable, nonsensical holiday special. So check that out if you get a chance. Next up, I have, this one is weird. So I guess there has been a few different series happening on God, what's the name of the service? Omletto, that have been doing these, sort of mini episodes, webisodes, involving different characters. And there was a show, I guess a web series a few years ago called Fresh Hell that had LeVar Burton and Brent Spiner. And, you know, that was sort of about them playing these hyper exaggerated characters themselves. I discovered this one this week, which just went up actually about a week ago, where Brent Spiner is basically playing this, you know, again, hyper exaggerated version of himself, and Perry Gilpin.
Isn't that called Big Bang Theory?
I guess there is one episode where he certainly does that, but it's called Brentwood, and it is about him. Perry Gilpin from Frasier plays his wife, and it's about him just sort of, you know, trying to sort of do his own thing and sort of lose the shackles of Star Trek, but also getting sort of dragged back into it. And it sort of plays up this like very funny rivalry between him and LeVar and the way the two of them interact. It is really, really funny. He sings, he's got like all these in jokes. It's only about 10 minutes long. Again, highly recommend. Made me laugh my butt off. Totally worth it. Both of those characters, both of the actors are really, really funny. Definitely worth checking out. I highly recommend this one.
Yeah, I saw this one, and I do remember some small web series that he had that had the similar setup of he's like a down on his luck kind of loser after Star Trek, and it's LeVar Burton, who in that series is like his, you know, good friend, or like the only friend he has left, but LeVar is like very Hollywood and feels like he has a lot of money and a lot of stuff going on and is very superficial, which is, they both seem very different than like what the real people would be like, and it does set it up pretty well in those, and I definitely enjoyed this one as a little mini movie of that concept.
Yeah, and then again, he's got like a big, like, you know, he keeps talking about, you know, I want to be on Broadway, I want to do Broadway, and then he keeps breaking into song and singing all these, and again, it's for those who are easily offended, it's got some swears, it's you know, he's having a pretty good time, you know, letting loose, but yeah, it's really funny. And you know, I think Fresh Hell was that first series from, I think it was like 6 or 7 years ago. And then this one is, it's called Brentwood, but it's very similar as far as the way that it's portraying these sort of hyper-exaggerated versions of these characters. But damn, it's funny. It's really funny. I don't play Data anymore. Next up, Big Mouth season 4. We got our first trailer for Big Mouth season 4 this week. I'm a huge Big Mouth fan. I think it's really, really funny, very smart show. So this is our first look. They announced that they dropped on social that they were going to do their first trailer, but they also announced the release dates. It's coming actually the first week of December, so it's very soon too that this is coming out. Again, show not for the easily offended. It is a wildly offensive show, but it is so funny. It is so smart. You know, obviously it's the coming of age story for all these kids. It talks very frankly about sex and sexuality and just, you know, what it's like to go through the perils of, you know, pubescence and all this stuff. So many incredibly talented people working on the show, Nick Kroll, John Mulaney. And the trailer is, again, wildly over the top. The idea of, you know, all the weird stuff that happens to these kids as they mature. I can't wait. I can't wait. It's so funny. And I can't wait to see this next season.
Cool.
And last this week, thank you for all listening to all my my wants and wishes here. The last thing I got this week was we did finally get our PS5. That's my update for the week. It finally arrived. We got it. It did end up coming on the afternoon of the Friday, so it was only about 24 hours late. We got it. We plugged it in. We checked it out. And one of the highlights was by far playing the first little bit of the Spider-Man Miles Morales game. Now, I was a big fan of the Spider-Man PS5 4 game that had come out, starring Peter Parker. Very, very well done, and really, really well realized. Very, very fleshed out, both as an adventure and also as, you know, a character development. This one, equally so, really does sort of drop you into Miles's world. You really get a taste of, you know, how he lives and who he is and the whole world. And it looks spectacular.
Does it look like it does on the TV commercial? Yeah. Like it's literally like real life, like realistic?
Yeah. Like the level of detail, the level of immersion, it is like playing a film. It is so incredibly realized. The detail, you know, you can go anywhere in New York and it feels like New York from top to bottom. You know, it has a very realized feel to it. It is a really impressive piece of work. Now, I've only just sort of dipped my toe in it. I've only played a little bit. I've seen online that it is not obviously as fulsome a game as the original Spider-Man game. This was sort of intended to be, you know, a 1.5 or a, you know, 1.1 episode for this. Mm. So it's a shorter adventure. So I'm not sure we're going to get quite as immersed in the world. But boy, what a way to grab people if they're sort of firing up this system and expecting it to be whiz bang. Damn, this is whiz bang.
And does it have, like, has it got that whole subscription, you can't really do much without paying a monthly thing?
No, nothing like that. No, and we talked about that last week. I mean, if you were buying the PS5 because you're the kind of gamer who is going to go online and play, you know, the Call of Duties or, you know, whatever those sort of online multiplayer games are, there is that. Those are out for the system. You can certainly do that. And for that, you will need to have a subscription so that you can play online. This game so far, no, not at all. Nothing required at all. There's no online component to it whatsoever, so that's not an issue. But it certainly is for people who do prefer to their gaming to be a social experience in that way.
Sure, right, cool. All right, well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you, where would they find
you? I'm on Twitter and Instagram as at JPK News.
All right, and Jaime, if people want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter as at Dev with the Hair.
All right, my name is Timitra, T-I-M-M-I-T-R-A, on the Twitter machine is where you'll find me. Until next time, we'll say bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. This is Jean-Luc Picard.
Shut up, Wesley.
Sorry, say again. Just the tag. Gotcha. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. You can get in touch with us on the website or follow us on Twitter at Spotcast. If you have feedback or questions, send us a tweet with the hashtag AskSpotcast. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/Spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
My phone told me to go to bed like half an hour ago. I have the new sleep thing reminding me to go to bed. I'm getting an extra hour of sleep every night, which is nice.
Yeah, I find the problem with those kind of programs is that you have to pay attention to them.
Oh, you don't have to pay attention to it. I mean, you can totally like sit and watch an episode of The Crown.
It's just a matter of time before the electric shock start, you know? Wasn't that the plot to a Stephen King
movie? Yeah. The electric shock is what happens the first thing in the morning when you have to get up and walk the dog. And yeah, you know,
I hear you.
I mean, I can't wait till we have to go back to an office and you have to get up like a whole 45 minutes earlier than we're doing now, right? You know?
Who earns?
Yep.
Not anywho, included in my watch list. One, I will say, I did get to the end of Truth Seekers, the Dick Frost, Simon Pegg deal. Mm-hmm. Definitely worth checking out. I'd recommend it to both of you. It's interesting. It still straddles that weird, like, humor, darkness thing through to the end. But it ties up in an interesting way, and it does sort of set the stage for some more interesting stuff to come.
Well, as a follow-up to the More Than Just Code podcast, I did watch The Queen's Gambit.
Oh, is that good?
Mm. Oh, it's really good.
That's on my to-do list.
It's a bit predictable in some parts, but like, no, it's really good. I mean, especially if you know anything about chess, you know, yeah. I don't have to know anything about chess, to be honest with you, but if you do know something about it, it's really good. Sort of, you know, rising up from the ashes kind of story.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like, is it Anya Taylor-Joy? I like her. I think she's an interesting performer. She's a very unusual face, but,
yes,
but she, well, you were saying, I think it was you that was saying she's, you keep seeing Emma Stone every time you look at her, right?
Well, yeah, initially. Yeah.
But,
well, it's a red wig. I mean, she doesn't naturally have red hair, yeah. but is in this show.
Yeah. But I like her. I think that's, I have sat down a couple of times and thought, oh, that, and I'm like, oh, no, I have to finish the other thing first. So
yeah. On the to-do list. Well, only reason I watch is because Mark had said, you know, he said you should definitely watch it. So, yeah. If you're a science or math or geek, any kind of geek person, good show.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
Yep. All right. Well, I guess that's it for today.
Oh, I guess. You want to just do another 2 hours?
Yeah. No, I have to go and I'll probably have to get up for work early in the morning too.
Yes. I'm his lucky one. It's not even 10 o'clock yet.
That's true. That's true.
I'm sure he's tired.
All right, gents.
All right.
See you next week.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.